QSO Today, episode 489, John Russiano, NG0Z. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored, as we no longer have commercial sponsors who can influence the content of this podcast. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. The following listeners have become sponsors by making monthly or yearly commitments: Fred Karslick, KA4RUR, Mike Rensman, 13R042. I want to thank Paul Barnes, W4YRL, for his $35 donation. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. There is a blog button at the top of the QSO Today homepage. I am blogging my take on the war in Gaza that you may or may not get in your part of the world. It is completely my opinion based on my extensive news reading and feet on the ground. Join me there if you want my perspective. John Russiano, NG0Z, knew that eventually living in an HOA would meet he and his family's needs, even if it meant not having a ham radio station and outside antennas. The state of the art and the ubiquitous internet connectivity made it possible for John to build his ultimate remotely controlled amateur radio station at his vacation home, away from the city electronic noise and the restrictions of HOA. NG0Z allows me to interrogate him about all aspects of building his remote station in this QSO Today. NG0Z, this is Eric 4Z1UG. Are you there, John?
I am. I hear you loud and clear. This is NG0Z in Minnesota.
And John, I so appreciate that you are using a great microphone in order for us to have this conversation, so everyone will say, "Wow, that podcast really sounded great." So I appreciate your coming and joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, as I think about my childhood, I remember just seeing radios up high in a closet shelf that my dad had. I think when he was a teenager or a young adult, there was a shortwave receiver, there was a public service receiver, and back then, you know, I was just super curious about anything electronic. You know, I would take things apart and a lot of times not put them back together again, unfortunately for my parents. But, you know, but I got these radios down. I remember when I was a kid, maybe 8 or 9 years old, and took the covers off and cleaned all the dust out of them, and just was so mesmerized by all these little components and the string that moves the little dial behind the, you know, the little indicator behind the dial, and that this somehow pulls voices out of the air, right? And just became really fascinated with anything that had to do with radios. And so when I remember getting the Radio Shack catalog and knowing, okay, I have like $16, right? Okay, what can I buy for $16 out of the Radio Shack catalog? And I had that little realistic 151 kit when I was a kid. And I made the little Morse code thing, and just have always been fascinated by radio and anything that radio does. And when we were kids, we'd play cops and robbers in the neighborhood, and we had walkie talkies, right? And we'd run around the whole neighborhood. And so what I would do is I had this little realistic CB60 receiver, and I would my bedroom was up on the second floor of the house, and I ran an earbud down to the ground and tuned the radio to the walkie-talkie frequency because we were out competing and trying to find each other. So I would try to quietly get back to the house, and I'd put the earbud in. I could hear where everybody is, and then everybody would wonder, how did you have this advantage of always knowing where we were? So I mean, just to have always been really into anything that a radio does and how it works. And so I had scanners and shortwave and was really just a listener for the most part. I tried a couple times to get my license when I was a kid, and just, I think the Morse code got in the way or life got in the way, whatever. But I've really never been without a radio to listen to, at least. And I remember it late at night when we were kids talking on the CB in bed. I had a little magnetic antenna hanging from the gutter outside my window, and we'd all have these, you know, during the CB days, I'd have a walkie-talkie on my the handlebars of my bike, and just we were really into anything that a radio could do.
Where was the hometown?
So I grew up out west of the Twin Cities for the most part in Orono, a western suburb of the Twin Cities, and but also lived for a while down in Stuartville, which is just south of Rochester, south of the Mayo Clinic and all that. And so that's actually where I graduated from high school. I wanted, my most favorite thing to listen to, though, over the years was other hams talking to each other. And I always sort of dreamed that someday that would be me.
What kind of radio did you use to listen to other hams? Was this a VHF range?
No, always HF. Yes, on my scanner, I would listen to the 2-meter guys talking, and especially it was kind of fun because they would have the radio telephone on 2-meter, and you could hear phone calls, and I thought that was really cool.
Right, the auto patch.
Yeah, but for the most part, it was listening to hams talk to foreign contacts and around the country, and it was just on shortwave receivers, and, you know, I had a realistic, what it was, a DX100, I think, and then I had a Kenwood, I think it was an R1000. Those were back then a really cool receiver. And so all through college, you know, I usually had, whether I lived in an apartment or rented a house when I was going to college, I always had some sort of long wire in the trees out back. And, you know, the landlord would ask, what is that? And it's just a shortwave receiving antenna. Well, it's not causing interference to the neighbors, is it? Well, no, I'm just listening. So it was just a quirky, geeky hobby that I've had since I was a little kid, and it was my favorite thing to do.
John, did you collect QSL cards? Not being a ham, but still being a shortwave listener, did you ever send messages or write to the hams that you were hearing and ask for their QSL cards?
No, I never did. You know, back then I didn't even know that that was a thing. I was just fascinated that this was a hobby that people talked to people around the world with each other. You know, it was just really cool to listen to.
You had this technical tendency. Did you kind of follow that through school, through your high school years?
Sort of. I mean, when I was in college, I studied journalism at the University of Minnesota, and I remember seeing a job posting for a TV news dispatch job at KSTP TV News, and I did that for a year and a half, when my job basically was to listen to all the scanners that they had there and to try to scoop the other stations by getting a camera crew to some sort of fire or accident before anybody else got there. And I got the job because Bruce Haggerty, who's also a ham, by the way, who was the general manager of the station at the time, I think he's retired now, but he hired me because I convinced him that nobody knows how to listen to scanners and to know what you're listening to and to operate them than I do. And I got the weekend TV news dispatch job for a year and a half. And that was a really cool way to basically get paid to do my hobby.
In a newsroom, how does that really work? You're listening to a whole bunch of stuff. Are you actually on the floor of the newsroom, or are you in a cubby somewhere and just kind of paying attention to everything?
Right. It was just off the newsroom floor. Every once in a while, when they would go to the newsroom floor, you could see me over the shoulder of the anchor person back in my little glass office back there. But my job was basically to listen to the scanners and then get on the radio to dispatch the camera crews to get to the scene of the events. Because what I learned back then was, if we can't get video, it's not news. It didn't happen, right? So my job was to get somebody there while the fire was still burning, while there was still smoke, while there was cars, you know, crashed into each other. If you didn't get a camera crew there, it didn't happen.
That was called what, ENG at the time, something like that? Electronic news gathering, or was that something that came later?
No, that was later. This was good old fashioned, just dispatching them on a radio and getting there with a camera crew.
They go shoot video and then bring the video back to the studio.
Right.
There was no microwave back to the studio.
Well, there was between, we had a microwave link between the station and the helicopter. And so my job there was to control the joystick because it was a directional antenna. It was a very narrow signal, right? And one of my claims to fame, so to speak, was during, I think it was the 1987 or 90, it was one of the World Series with the Twins. And the network feed coming over the stadium was a KSTP TV helicopter. And I was controlling, because it was moving, right? So I had to keep kind of guessing which way to move the joystick to keep that signal clear so that when they broke to a commercial, the video was clear and the helicopter was moving. And I had to kind of look at a signal strength meter and keep kind of messing with the joystick to keep the signal in the safe zone or whatever.
We don't know that those things are going on in the back rooms.
Well, and they had three people standing behind me so that somebody could take over in case I started messing up or passed out or whatever.
Okay, so you went to journalism school. What happened after that?
So my first job out of school was selling insurance. So it really wasn't related to the hobby in any way. I just ended up working for someone that I thought was doing something that I would enjoy. But one of my clients back then was selling car phones and really doing well. And this was when nobody had car phones. So pretty much everybody that you sold a car phone or a portable or, you know, the brick phone, it was their first ever cell phone. And they were very expensive and complicated. And so you bought them. Today, obviously, you buy them in a retail store or over online or whatever. But back then, it was really a person-to-person sale because you had to teach people how to use them and how to program them. But in any case, he was doing very well.
Was this pre-cellular, can I ask? Was it like before 1985?
It was the very beginnings. It was the very beginnings of cellular. It was late 80s. When they were really starting to become a business tool and a consumer tool. And so I quit my job selling insurance and went into the mobile phone business basically. And that was a good 12, 14 year career with various carriers and worked my way up into management. But basically it was really basically selling radios that acted like telephones and just was a great career to be in back then. And I had a lot of celebrities that were customers because, you know, a lot of successful business owners and physicians and real estate agents. And, you know, as I would drive around in my car, I had a fax in the back seat back then and was connected to another cell phone. And, you know, the fax was the size of a suitcase sitting back there, but I would sometimes take an order and I would fax it back to the office and then go to my next appointment. And, you know, nobody was doing that back then. And, you know, just sitting in a restaurant with my brick phone, which, you know, for me, it was free, you know, people just come up and say, "Hey, I've been thinking about getting one of these. Can I get your business card?" And it was just a really fun business to be in for someone that's interested in radios. And, you know, the other salespeople could care less, but I thought it was the coolest thing in the world to actually make a living selling something that was just so cool.
Well, you're so savvy as a salesman. I can hear it already. I was selling car phones in those days, too, in the mid to late 80s. I would never have thought of sitting in a restaurant. That's probably why you were such a good salesman and I wasn't.
I used to carry a little handheld recorder in my hand or in the car. I'd leave it in the car and I would see a plumbing contractor or a builder or basically any business where their phone number is on the side of their truck.
Right.
And I would all day long record that, Joe's Plumbing, 612, blah, blah, blah. And then when I'd get back to the office, I would replay it, write all the names and numbers down, and I would cold call these folks, and I would get appointments that way. And I sold a lot of phones that way just by being observant and taking down names and numbers and calling them back.
How did you get back into amateur radio? Because it seems to me that you had this early interest in amateur radio, but you kind of put it off for a while, obviously, to build a family, to build a career, all that stuff like many people do. Well, what happened?
Well, it was the winter of 2013. We got a bunch of snow really early that year. And so winter came really early. And I just, something snapped. And I just said, you know what, this is the winter. I'm going to finally get the license done. And so I bought Ham Test online, and I went from zero to extra in 100 days and just studied every night at the kitchen table. And Dale, KD0B, a good friend of mine was the VE that I took my test with. He has a group in Chanhassen, and they do it at least once a month. But anyways, you know, I started Googling, where do I take my test? And he said, hey, by the way, if you sit down and you pass the technician, you can sit that night for the general too, and you just pay the $14 once. And so I'm like, well, great. So then I studied for those two, went and took both of them, passed them the first try, and then came back a month later and got my extra. And because that's the first thing, obviously, is get your license. But that winter really persisted. So, I mean, we had 3 feet of snow in the backyard, so I really couldn't get outside and start putting up antennas or doing anything. So I just bought a little handy talkie and got started on FM and practiced, you know, that. And you know, I still had radios to listen to other hams. And so that spring, as soon as the snow was melted enough to be able to trudge around in the backyard, I hung a G5 RV across two trees that kind of hung over the lake that we lived on, and ran the coax in through the basement sliding glass door, and ran up to Radio City, which unfortunately no longer exists, but we actually had a radio store here in town, which was awesome. And I bought a 7600 and a power supply and an SM50 mic and an antenna tuner. And I just, that weekend, I just got on the air and nobody saw me that whole weekend. I was down in the basement the whole weekend, making contacts and getting on the air and just having a blast. And so I was age 49, so I started late. And so part of my ham radio journey, if you want to call it that, has been making up for lost time.
When you say it was a heavy snow, does that mean that you're actually, are you snowed in for months at a time, or how does that really work?
No, but if you have, it's really hard to walk around in your backyard that winter, at least when we had so much snow. To be able to run a cord into the house or anything, it's just really difficult to walk around back there. So, you know, we do get a lot of snow, but that cuts both ways too, because ham radio is a great thing to do in the winter when there's nothing else you can do.
Well, that's why maybe working on antennas is a seasonal activity, right? You do that when you have grass and sunshine.
Yep. You have a window of time where you can work on stuff, at least comfortably. I would not want to be working on my antennas in the winter.
I lived in Colorado for 16 years, and it would snow, and then 2 days later it was melted off.
Right. Very different.
So I'm assuming in Minnesota, it snows in October and it stays.
Yeah. Well, it's very rare to get, in fact, it was really rare to get snow as early as we did back then in 2013, because we were, basically the snow came and stayed the first week of November, if I recall. And that's not normal. I mean, Thanksgivings, you probably have a 50-50 chance of having a white Thanksgiving and probably a 75 to 80% chance of having a white Christmas around here. But that year, we got early, heavy snow, and it stayed the whole winter.
It's my understanding that Minnesota is also the land of 1,000 lakes, something like that?
It's actually, our license plates say 10,000, but there's actually around 15,000 lakes in Minnesota.
So I have a question from a ham radio standpoint. Are you an ice fisherman?
A little bit. We have a cabin on a lake, which is where the station is. It can be fun. It's like any hobby. You spend a little bit of your time fishing and the rest of your time talking and maybe having a cocktail or two. it's big around, especially up by the cabin. There's a ton of lakes up there, and you'll see pickup trucks and 4x4s, and you'll see trailers and houses. And we're very near Lake Mille Lacs, which is one of the larger lakes in Minnesota, and they actually plow streets. And rumor has it they have stoplights out there some years when it gets really busy. And
so you're saying on the lake itself?
Yeah, right on the lake.
On the water. I mean, on the ice.
On the water. Yep. Yep. There's like little cities out there, basically.
Can you imagine that there would be parks on the air? There would be ice fishing on the air or ice cabin on the air?
That would be a great idea. You just need a generator, and certainly it'd be easy enough to set up an antenna on the ice. Sure, that's a great idea.
And then people from around the country could actually get into Minnesota ice fishing with an amateur radio event.
Yeah.
I'm putting this in the notes because maybe you'll have an interest.
We should run with that, yep.
Okay, so this is really great. Now, it's my understanding, though, that as you progressed in your ham radio journey, are you no longer on the lake in terms of where you live now? I got a message from you that said that you're in an HOA.
Right. So we used to live 5 minutes north of here in Minnetonka, Minnesota, and I had my station in the basement, and I had a tower, And my last antenna on that was a stepper urban beam. And then I had a vertical, and then I had a wire, and I had a decent station in my home. And, but we ended up moving. We fell in love with a new neighborhood about 5 minutes away. And, you know, HOA neighborhood, brand new townhomes, very closely spaced. And I talked to the realtor. We just saw it on an open house. I talked to the realtor and I said, do you think the owner or the builder would allow me to have a ham radio antenna? And he said, you know, he's a pretty open-minded guy. He might entertain that. And I think the realtor knew right well that there's no way that, but he wanted to keep me interested. Right. And so, so then we kept seeing the house and just assuming that maybe there was a chance. Right. And, turns out there was no chance, but we ended up buying the house anyways. I'm actually treasurer for the HOA, so I have nothing against HOAs. I think they're a good thing for the most part. It's just that for ham radio operators, they're definitely an obstacle. But having had so many QSOs over the years with people that had remote stations, I just took a chance. I just figured, you know, I've got this cabin up north. It's got good power, good internet. I'm just going to have to build a station up there, and I'll just operate it remotely. Or at least when I'm up there, I can at least get on the air from time to time. But as I started researching it, I discovered, you know, there are people that operate remotely 100% of the time. And I became also a subscriber during this time to remote ham radio, which is really cool. It's not cheap, but it's a great setup. It's a great way for people to try the hobby or to see what it's like to operate a superstation. But that really sort of encouraged me that, you know, this is a station that is 100% remote for people all over the world to log in and use. Why can't I just build something like that? And so that's when I enlisted my son's help, because he's a electrical engineer by degree and a software salesperson by career. And I just started asking him, well, how would we do this? I know what radio and tower and antenna and all that stuff I would want, but how do we do everything else? The internet, the power, the lightning protection, you know, all the other aspects. Can you start putting your brain to get on this? And here's my credit card, basically, and tell me what to buy. And so we started having Zoom meetings together and building the spreadsheet, which ended up being my shopping list. And it just sort of started coming together that I'm going to build a dream station that I will operate remotely up at the cabin. And so it was a significant investment that we made. And it took basically a year and a half of specifying and ordering and waiting for things to arrive and then waiting for people to show up to dig a hole in the ground and pour concrete and all those different pieces that people that have done this know all about. And by August of 2022, the station was up and running.
And now this mid-show break. The future of podcasting and the QSO Today podcast is listener sponsorship. It keeps us lean and focused on providing you the best ham radio interviews since 2014. You can keep the QSO Today podcast commercial and sponsor-free by becoming a listener sponsor yourself. For $10 a month or save 20% at $100 per year, you can become a listener sponsor. I am now recording the QSO Today podcast as video interviews that are available only as a benefit to listener sponsors through our QSO Today community website. As I develop the sponsorship tier, I will add bonus content for listener sponsors. Listener sponsors, not donors, are automatically members of the new QSO Today Academy. I am building the Academy website to include access to our SQL I/O networking lounges all of the time and Academy resources, including over 400 previous expo presentations with Q&A and additional helpful ham radio educational resources. The benefit of listener sponsorship as an alternative to commercial sponsorship is that commercial sponsors influence the content and comments in the podcast. Listener sponsorship allows a greater degree of freedom to discuss any ham radio subject without commercial consequence. I have eliminated all commercials in the QSO Today podcast from episode 445, with the exception of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast, as I think that this is a serious asset to a well-rounded ham radio education. I am not using Buy Me a Coffee or Patreon, but my own system for managing the community that could form out of the podcast. I direct you to the sponsorship section of the show notes pages beginning with the episode 444, where I list all of the contributors to the podcast since 2014, including sponsors, donors, and hams who have paid for transcriptions. If sponsorship is not your interest, then you can make any size donation to the podcast by clicking on the donation button on the QSO Today podcast website at qsotoday.com. There is a slider that you can use to adjust the amount of your donation. If you want to make your donation monthly, click on the recurring donation box. It is the recurring donations and the listener sponsorships that keep the lights burning here. Finally, you don't have to contribute anything to listen to the QSO Today podcast. You can use my Amazon affiliate link before shopping at Amazon by clicking on it on the right side of the show notes page. This will signal Amazon to send us a small percentage of what you purchase. This is the most painless way to ensure that the QSO Today project will be here next week. I want to thank everyone who has contributed and will contribute to my effort to create this oral history of amateur radio since 2014. It will eventually all be in the public domain for hams in the future to enjoy. Be sure to become a listener sponsor or make a donation today. And now we return to our QSO Today. So you actually have your son kind of help you be the project manager of this project, and that's actually how you treated it. You're not going to throw a few radios in a box with some extension cords and a router and a modem and take it up there and just put it on a table and operate it. There will be pictures. John has been kind enough to give me pictures to put in the show notes page, and it's actually quite involved. It's really very professional and very beautiful. So how did you decide on which radios to use for this? Because certainly there's a number of manufacturers that operate remote control solutions. There's remote rigs that allows you to take a control head off of an HF radio and remotely control it. What was the criteria that you were looking for in order to come up with the kind of control and user experience that you wanted?
Well, you know, anecdotally, it seemed to me that when people operated remotely and wanted the ultimate in remote operation, they were almost always on flex radios. And, you know, this is going to turn into a little bit of a commercial for them, but I have had an awesome experience. And the easiest part of the station was the radio. You know, I pulled that Flex 6400 out of the box and plugged a LAN cord in the back of it, downloaded a piece of software onto a laptop. I was literally operating the radio remotely as I was testing it on the bench. In about a minute and a half is how long it took. I mean, so that was the easy part to decide on. And then the tuner and the amp, I just wanted everything from the same family, so to speak, so that when you're building a remote station that's a two-hour drive, you're thinking in terms of, yeah, it's going to be a dream station, but it's also got to be reliable. I want everything to be seamless and integrated and to eliminate things that could go wrong by mixing one brand of amp with a different brand of radio or what have you. And I was working from a clean slate. I had sold all the stuff from my old station. I was a big ICOM fan before. I had a 7610 and a PW1 for the same reason, to integrate with the same manufacturer because they can talk to each other. And so the research that I had done and the anecdotal, you know, research that I had done via, you know, having QSOs with other people that are operating remotely, was that Flex is kind of the ultimate in remote operation.
Okay. And all of their pieces like Power Genius and Antenna Genius, right? All of these devices are Ethernet connected?
Right. Exactly. The way that the Flex amp, tuner, and radio communicate is, I think, basically via your router. They find each other, essentially. There's no other connection between them.
How did you decide how you were going to do the antenna arrangement out there? What was the criteria?
I mean, honestly, making up for lost time a little bit, I wanted to have the best I could find in, you know, within reason, right? I had somewhat of a budget in mind, which I blew through anyways. But in any case, you know, I'm 59 years old in a couple weeks here, and I'm not a big tower climber. And certainly as you get older, you're less inclined to do that. So I wanted to have a tower that I could tilt over if I needed to work on my antenna. So I bought a US tower, tilt up, crank over tower. And I couldn't find the one I wanted used. Otherwise, I probably would have gone used, but I bought it new. And then I wanted as much as possible to have everything on one antenna for simplicity's sake. And I really was leaning towards doing a stepper antenna, and I had some conversations with them, and I had a stepper urban beam at my old station. I love the stepper technology, that, you know, how the antenna kind of tunes everywhere you go. But in a remote station in Minnesota with just about every extreme you can imagine, and being a drive away, and it's not just that it's a 2-hour drive for me, but it's a 3-hour drive for my friend Denny K0TT, who's been instrumental in all of my ham radio pursuits these last few years, because he's my tower guy and he's my companion when we're putting together a new antenna, or, you know, I'm begging him for his time, and, you know, to come and help me. I didn't want to have a station that had a tower with, or an antenna with moving parts, if it meant another 3-hour drive for him, right? Because I needed his help. And so I wanted an antenna that doesn't have any moving parts. And so I ultimately ended up with a JK XR7, which covers 40 through 10, and then I have the 6-meter kit on it. It doesn't cover 30 meters, but otherwise it covers all the bands between 40 and 6. And I tried a Mosley for a while. That didn't work out for me as well. But Ken at JK was awesome, and it covers everything except for 80 and 160, which I'm still trying to figure out how to at least get on 80. I think this summer will be the next project, is to hang an inverted V from the tower to get on 80 at least, so I can reconnect with some of my local and regional friends on 80 meters. But I wanted an antenna that covered basically the meat of the bands and was up, you know, 70, 75 feet and was durable. And perhaps I could have up for 15 or 20 years with very little maintenance.
Now it's up 75 feet, which from your pictures looks like it's actually above the tree line.
Yeah, it's just above the canopy, which is nice because it gets a little bit of wind protection.
It looks like it was a crank-up tower that also tilts over. Do you actually raise and lower that tower when you're not using it to maybe move it from the wind and stuff like that?
I can, in that I do have the means, and that I haven't connected yet. That's another project on the list. I did buy that option that you can raise and lower the tower on site from inside the shed, so to speak, but it's not hard to get some Wi-Fi relays and connect it up so that you can do it remotely. And I would like to be able to do that someday, so that if I'm looking at the radar up at the cabin from down here in the city and I see the storm of the century coming or something like that, where I could lower the antenna. So that's definitely, I don't know if I'd be comfortable raising it without being there, but certainly lowering it to get it out of harm's way would be a great feature to have. As it stands, I have neighbors that are good friends that know the lock code to get into the little enclosure. And you basically, you plug the tower in, you flip a switch, and it lowers itself and stops itself. So that's my, and in fact, one of them is a ham, good friend of mine across the lake, Gary. He knows how to buzz over and put it down if I saw that storm coming.
Did you put a television camera, a camera on the tower itself or up at the antenna so that you could actually see what the storm looks like that's coming, or what the direction is of the DX that you're working?
I definitely have cameras, none of them aiming up at the antenna, but I definitely have cameras around the base. So if there's kids or someone from the neighborhood that is curious about what's going on there, I've got warning signs and everything like that up and around the tower, but I don't have a camera aimed up to see what's going on with the antenna, but I do obviously get feedback as to which direction it's turning from the Green Heron system.
Is that an antenna rotating controller?
Right. So I have a Green Heron controller, and then I have the Green Heron Everywhere software on a PC at the station. And then I access that with Chrome Remote Desktop. So I can access the computer on site with Chrome Remote Desktop to reduce the amount of bandwidth that I need going between here in the city and the station. And that was an idea that I got from Mike at Flex Radio. So I control the amp and the tuner, some of the other peripherals with the computer on site by just drilling into it remotely with Chrome Remote Desktop. So that basically on my, when I'm sitting here, my left screen is basically a duplicate of the screen up at the station. And so it's as if I'm standing right there.
Was there a special criteria in choosing the computer that goes into your remote station. You wouldn't, it seems like you need more than a Raspberry Pi in terms of what you're monitoring and controlling, perhaps. It seems to me that you have potential issues with power fluctuations due to weather or things like that. What was the criteria that you used to select the computer that's in the rack?
It's just a mini Lenovo PC. It's just one of those little small form factor computers. In fact, you can see it in one of the pictures. It's just this little box that sits at the top of the rack there. And you'd be surprised how little of its resources all of this actually uses. And one of the reasons is as much of the heavy use of bandwidth and such is carried over the Flex side of things. So the Flex app that resides on my laptop down here at the station connects with the radio and the amp, but everything else comes over Chrome Remote Desktop.
If you're using Flex Radio, you're using the Flex app at your house, and it's talking directly to the radios. It's not talking through the computer.
Yes. The way that the Flex app works is that to validate a connection, you have to go through the Flex server. But once you're validated that this is your radio and you're its rightful owner and you're all logged in, it becomes what's called a peer-to-peer connection between you and your radio over the internet. So Flex sort of gets out of the way at that point, and now you're connected directly to your radio over the internet. And so that's great because, and I'm not a computer technician, so I don't know exactly how this all works. I just know that if Flex is having an issue with their servers, but you're already validated, well, you're still on the air. But if you need to log in again, then there, you know, you do rely on their server to connect, at least initially. Back to your question about the computer, one of the issues that we did have the first winter was we had an extended power outage. And unfortunately, it occurred right in the middle of a Windows update on the PC at the local site. And it did corrupt the operating system. And so I had to run up there, grab the computer, bring it home, wipe it clean, rebuild all the software, put it back up there. And to prevent that happening in the future, then I installed a UPS system so that now if we have a power outage, that doesn't affect any of the radio or rotor control equipment or the amp or the tuner. As soon as the power is restored, that stuff all boots up. But the computer was an issue because if, as they say, when you're doing a software update on a computer, don't interrupt your power. Make sure your computer has enough battery. And that's exactly what happened, is the power outage happened right in the middle of an update. So now the computer is connected to a UPS system. And so if power is cut, the computer stays running. And if it continues or persists, the UPS system sends a command to the PC to boot itself down. And then when the power is restored, a command is sent for the computer to boot itself back up, and then I'll see my station again about 3 minutes later.
Is there other hardware, software in there for, say, monitoring temperature and the lights in the place, the heat? Are you heating the rack, or does the rack heat itself when it gets 50 below zero?
Yeah, well, the rack heats itself. I have a 4x4 shed inside a 24x48 pole shed. So I basically have a shack within the shed that acts as a little bit of a cocoon around the equipment. And, Flex says it's fine to do this. I just leave everything running in standby mode, which creates just enough heat to keep things warm inside there in the winter. Now, the UPS system is a little more challenging because it actually has liquid batteries in it, right? So that can freeze. And so Mike at Flex Radio suggested, well, you know what you do is you get one of these reptile heating pads. It's like 8 inches by 12 inches, and it has a good pad. Stick that on the bottom of the UPS system. Buy the version that has a thermostat. So I set that at 55 degrees. That keeps the UPS system from freezing. But otherwise, Mike said, you know, the radio in your car turns on when it's cold, doesn't it? I'm like, well, yeah, okay, well, so will ours. And so you don't really worry. So heat's probably more of an enemy to your equipment than cold is, and moisture too. But so in the summer, it gets really hot in the shed. And so I have exhaust fans that come on that I can flip on remotely, because I can watch the temperature of not only the ambient temperature inside the shed. I have a little internet enabled temperature and humidity sensor from it's called TempStick. It's about $130 on Amazon, and it connects to Wi-Fi and it's battery operated. And so that tells me what the temperature is inside the little shack or the little shed. And then I can flip on these exhaust fans that suck the hot air out of it and keep things within the operating range of the equipment.
You don't feel that you need it to have some kind of air conditioning in there?
No.
Doesn't get that hot?
No, not yet. Not yet, at least. I mean, it gets, you know, I've seen it as high as 105 degrees inside the little shed. And so you turn the fans on and it brings it down quite a bit.
In terms of having fans that move air in and out of the shed, do you use some kind of filters in order to keep dust and critters and stuff like that from coming in?
Yes. I actually had an HVAC guy that does HVAC, you know, heating and cooling equipment, and he also does radon ventilation for homes. Yeah, yeah. And so he kind of combined some of the different equipment that he uses for these things. And so I've got a blower fan that sucks air out of the upper part of the little shed inside the shed. And then the other side near the floor is a hole that he cut with a vent. And then there's a furnace filter that clips over the hole so that it filters it just like you would in your heating system in your house. And so I just have to replace that filter every once in a while.
And that pole shed, is that also being used as a shop when you're there, or is it just used for storage?
Yeah, it's kind of my happy place. I've got a big workbench in there, and I've got the snowmobiles and the jet skis and all the toys for the cabin are all jammed in there too. So it's basically a man cave. I mean, I've got my radio station. I've got all the toys for up at the cabin that we store there. And it's just, it's across the street from the cabin. The shed is not heated or cooled, hence all of the issues with trying to keep the equipment kind of within its operating range. But, and then there's critters too, by the way. I mean, mice can get in there every once in a while if you don't keep it sealed up well. And I'm sure mice would love to make a nest in and around that equipment in the winter if you let them get at it. So that's the other reason that I have the shed built around the equipment, is to keep critters out.
It sounds to me like you've kind of checked all the boxes in terms of anticipating the potential problems.
Right.
Now, I noticed that you're using a data probe. It's a great company, by the way, Data Probe AC control panel that's remotely controlled. I got the sense of looking at some of the pictures that maybe there is a sequence when you turn things on. Do they all go on at the same time? Or is there some kind of a sequence that you turn things on one after the other?
There is. And with the Data Probe, which is basically a really sort of complicated and expensive internet power plug is what it is. It's basically a big rack mounted power strip. But what you get when you have a device like this is you get the ability to program it to do certain things under certain conditions. So every 5 minutes, it looks for Google. And if it doesn't see Google, it assumes there's no internet connection. So it reboots the internet up in the shed until such time that it sees Google again. That's one of the features of it. The other thing that you can do is you can program these sequences where you can boot up your station, and you can create this sequence of what devices are going to come on, so which plug comes on when, and you can create these delays in between. And so I've got a sequence for rebooting the radio, shutting down the whole station, initiating the whole station. So for example, I've got this Paradan device that I bought at DX Engineering that when you cut power to it, it grounds your coax, and you can ground up to 2 coax lines to provide additional lightning protection. And so if I see a storm coming where I'm worried about lightning, and I've got a lightning alert on my phone that tells me if there's lightning near the station up north, I can shut the whole station down, which also grounds the coax. And Flex has a certain sequence that they want you to turn your power supply on, and I think you're supposed to wait 2 minutes and then turn the radio on, and vice versa when you're cold booting things. And so you just program that into the Data Probe and just hit a button, and it either shuts your whole station down or reboots the whole station up. Or I can also surgically go in and reboot the amp if it's not talking to the radio the right way, or I can reboot the tuner, so I can reboot different devices if they become disconnected with each other.
How is your internet connected to your station? Is that ADSL, or is it fiber, or how are you getting your internet connection?
It's cable. I actually had the cable company install another premise at the shed versus trying to connect with the cabin across the street or to connect with it wirelessly. So I kind of decided not to cut any corners there either. And so I had them add another account and another premise to the shed, and then everything inside the shed that is radio or station related is hardwired to the internet. So I don't use any wireless whatsoever. But that also poses an issue because now you have another source of power surge that could get into your radio, your amp, your tuner, and your peripherals. And so I buffered all of the internet connections with fiber optics. And this was an idea from another ham that operates remote flex station as well. And he said, you know, one more thing you got to realize is that flex equipment is connected another way where a power surge could come through. And here's a way of solving it fairly inexpensively. And so so every internet connection to all these devices has a fiber optic gap in it, if you will, so that a power surge can't come through that way. So I have Wi-Fi cameras and I have Wi-Fi security system and all that, but all of the equipment is hardwired to the internet. And one thing that I learned is when you're operating a station remotely, it's not about bandwidth. Certainly you need minimum bandwidth, but it's not as much as you might think. What is critical is latency, which is a euphemism for delay, basically. And I have about a 60 millisecond delay between here where I sit and my station, which is 107 miles north of me, which is virtually imperceptible. People can't tell.
I do this for a living. It's amazing. It's funny. I'm so glad that I asked the question because I've been doing the internet connection stuff for years and years, and most people don't realize that most lightning strikes, when they hit, come in on the phone lines to destroy your office, your home office or something. And so you took yourself right where I wanted to go, and that was is that you actually have this fiber bridge between any of the connections outside that could come in and actually take you out. I don't think that most people would actually, unless they had that experience, would actually know that they think they've covered it by disconnecting the antenna coax, but that the lightning could come in, you know, on one of the low voltage lines.
Well, and I'd love to tell you that I came up with these ideas, but I didn't. I mean, these are ideas that I got on the air talking to other hams. And this was after I had the station up and running. And I wish I could remember his call sign. He's in Indianapolis and as a flex guy and a remote guy. And he said, hey, one more thing you need to, did you think of this? And I'm like, no, that's a great idea. And I immediately ordered the stuff and called my son and we got it implemented. And so really a lot of this is just a culmination of picking other people's brains that have done this before me and then just implementing something to proactively solve all the problems that you can anticipate happening to a station and all the environment or all the elements that it's exposed to.
I want to take a minute to tell you about my favorite podcast, the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast with George, KJ6VU, and now joined by Rod, VA3ON, Mike, VA3MW, Mark, N6MTS, and Vince, VE6LK. Every 2 weeks, George and company offer up a status report on the many amateur radio projects on their workbenches and explore projects on their guests' workbenches. This group is project active and prolific, covering many technical areas of amateur radio. So the next time you want a deep dive into ham radio electronic project building, or to learn about technology, tools, test equipment, construction techniques, and the rest, listen to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, available on every podcast player and channel. Use the link in this week's show notes page to get to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast directly. And now back to my QSO. Now, we pretty much laid out the station. The station's 2 hours away. You're able to operate it with a 60 millisecond latency. This is absolutely wonderful. Now, what do you do with it? What do you like to operate, and how do you like to operate?
So when I flip open the laptop and get on the air, the first thing I'm looking for is DX. My goal is to get every country in the world or every entity in the world via Logbook of the World. If somebody sends me a card and they email me, hey, I sent you a card, can you send me one back? Sure. And they don't need to give me postage or anything like that. But to me, I love the idea of doing it virtually and not mailing cards around the world. And so my goal is to do the entire DXCC spectrum of, what is it, 336 countries or whatever, via Logbook of the World. And so the first thing I'm looking for is my next DX score on Logbook of the World. I'm up to 255 now. I've had a real nice string of maybe a dozen or so the last few weeks here with all the de-expeditions and such. And then once I feel like, okay, you know, between Ham Alert and the different clusters and everything, if I feel like, okay, I've exhausted that, then I usually find a frequency open on 17 meters or 20 or 40 and just call CQ and see who comes back to me and rag chew and meet new people and talk about whatever. I mean, that's just the fun of the hobby is there's something for everybody. And then I've developed an appreciation for FT8, honestly, because that's been a way to add to my score and to make contacts. You know, Minnesota in some instances is a pretty good place for DX, but there's certain places of the world that are going to be really tough to make a contact with, even with a station like mine, where you've got a big antenna and a fair amount of power. There's just places around the world where it's going to be really difficult to have a sideband conversation. So FT8 has been valuable there. So I usually just do DX on FT8. I usually don't have a lot of connections with domestic stations, at least not yet. But I've actually acquired an appreciation for non-voice mode as well.
Do you block out time in your calendar in order to be able to take the time to operate? Or do you have a set time every day? Do you try to get to it on a regular basis? How do you do that on your calendar? Because you're a busy guy.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes I'll have a break between appointments at the office and my watch or my phone will buzz with a DX contact on FT8 and I'll sneak on the radio at the office and try to chase after it there. I really don't block out time for it. If my wife is working out, I'll run into the radio room and get on the radio for an hour. You know, so it's really something that I'm on the radio almost every day, but it really varies. It depends on if I'm home and don't have appointments or it's the weekend and I've got some free time to myself. Pretty much I'm either, you know, reading or working out or on the radio.
What it sounds like to me is because this is available over the internet and you have your laptop all pre-configured for working DX, it means that you could do this anywhere. You can do it from the office. You can do it from home. Do you do it from the cabin across the street from the pole barn?
I do. I always say I'm 100% remote, whether I'm up there or down here, up at the cabin. I even set up the laptop on the workbench, and so I'm right next to the station, but I'm still operating remotely. And I'll sit at the kitchen table across the street at the cabin, and it's 25 milliseconds delay there, so it's a little bit quicker even. But, you know, I operate remotely there. I was at the Mayo Clinic for a medical exam, you know, kind of a customary thing that we do every couple of years. We go down to Rochester, and I was in a hotel room between my series of doctor's appointments that I had down there, and I was on the laptop in the hotel room and was making DX contacts and rag chewing and having fun. I listened on an airplane with my iPad on the way to Hawaii, using the airplane's Wi-Fi connecting to my station. You're not really supposed to transmit, I don't think, on an airplane, even though technically you're not, because it's over the internet. But I made a contact to Vietnam, poolside in Hawaii, connected back to Minnesota over the pool's Wi-Fi with my iPad, and made a contact with Vietnam. And a couple of days later, he confirmed with me on Logbook of the World. So that was an all-time new one for me. And I thought that was kind of cool.
When you're using public Wi-Fi and stuff, do you operate a VPN in order to keep from getting into a man-in-the-middle attack?
No. And I suppose there's an exposure there, but I haven't had any problems yet. But I don't do that very often where I'm using my station with Wi-Fi. Even here in our home, everything's my laptop is hardwired to eliminate that extra.
And you use an iPad. Do you ever try to use it on your phone? And is the Flex application for phones a workable solution for operating DX?
You know, anywhere I usually have my phone with me, I usually have my iPad, and I don't operate on the iPad that often because it's just as easy to have kind of a ham radio go kit. It's a backpack with an extra power supply for the laptop. And so I can throw my laptop and the Flex radio control knob and my mouse in a backpack and go. I'll take it up to the cabin. I take it to a hotel room. And so the nice thing about the iPad app for Flex is it has FT8 built into it, which is what got me started with FT8. And then I subsequently downloaded WSJTX, and now I use that for FT8 for the most part. But I know a lot of people prefer the iPad or Mac app for Flex because of some of the functionality that it has. But for me, that's kind of a, if I only have my iPad nearby and my ham alert goes off that there's a station that I need or want, sure, I'll grab it and give it a try. And but for the most part, I really just use the gaming laptop that I have as kind of the centerpiece of my operating position.
Now, this is a wonderful application for someone that lives in an HOA, and you've certainly taken it to the top level. Do you still own any radios that you actually operate from a workbench or from a park bench or something like that?
Yeah, I do still own a 7300 that I used with a wire in between stations up at the cabin before the new station came online. And a friend, I've lent that out to a friend who's a new ham and who's getting his boys interested in the hobby. And so that's kind of out being lent out with the antenna tuner. So I really don't, I haven't collected any of my old radios, which sometimes I regret that because, you know, when I was a kid dreaming of being a ham, I always dreamt of these big, huge boxes with the digital display and knobs and buttons and dials everywhere. And that's always what I thought of what a ham radio looked like. And the last radio that I had that was a traditional radio was an ICOM 7610. It's probably my all-time favorite radio because of the form factor. So operating this way is a little different because you're clicking and pointing and looking at a computer screen when you're on the air. You get used to it, but it still isn't the same as the knobs and the dials and buttons. And so I wish I would have maybe hung on to some of those old devices. But by the same token, the people that bought that equipment from me, you know, got a great deal on it. And it's another ham that's on the air now. And so I really don't keep stuff around if I'm not using it.
Do you operate mobile?
No, I don't. I have the 2 meter handheld that sometimes I'll take in the truck. And I used to do Skywarn stuff. And I'd like to, the pandemic kind of made it tough. I'm not up to date on the tornado training anymore. So I'd like to get back into that. And perhaps then I would install something in the truck.
As a relatively new ham, although it's now, 10 years in 2024, what could we do to attract more people to the hobby? Is there some secret sauce that you've thought about in terms of being able to bring more people in to share this amazing hobby with them?
Well, that is a topic that is sort of near and dear to my heart because I have so many friendships and just derive so much joy from this hobby. The social aspect as well as the geekery, you know, the radios and the knobs and the dials and the technology. And just like any hobby, you know, you spend half the time talking about your station and half your time actually being on your station. But you know, I think I've been pleased. I'm always promoting the hobby for one thing. I have a Facebook page and I'm sharing stuff with friends. And anytime somebody asks me about the hobby, you know, I'll go on and on about it, obviously, because, you know, I really enjoy it. And, but I think that, what I would say, you know, some of the things that I think are really instrumental for new hams and for the hobby is, you know, a lot of people poo-poo FT8, for example, but, you know, during the pandemic when people were homebound, you know, a lot of people got into our hobby, I think, because I've talked to so many of them during the pandemic with a 7300 and a wire and FT8. And promoting that technology instead of poo-pooing it, I think, is one thing that we all should be doing because it's a great way for people to get in the hobby with an inexpensive but effective station, make contacts all over the world, and discover that wonder of putting your call sign out there and somebody comes back to you from 10,000 miles away. It's just really amazing to me still to this day. It never ceases to bring me joy to hang your call sign out there and have somebody come back to you. You know, people say, well, can't you just Skype them or call them? Or, well, no, not randomly. This is a random thing. You know what I mean? And so to me, you know, I used to even poo-poo, you know, two computers having a QSO. That doesn't sound interesting to me. And then I tried it. And FT8 to me is like fishing. It's very relaxing. It's a different way of communicating for sure. And it's not a rag chew and it's not personal. But it's another technology. You know, sideband used to be the latest innovation years ago that people were poo-pooing and said, well, AM is the only way to go. Well, now everybody's on sideband. Well, FT8 is the latest and greatest. But it's attracted a lot of young, new hams to the hobby. And now that, you know, the sun cycle is helping us and conditions are much better, now they're getting on voice and they're expanding their investment and they're buying more equipment and they're adding more antennas. But I think FT8 and the pandemic and the 7300 almost single-handedly brought, I don't know how many new hams, but I think there's a resurgence of the hobby because of these three things coming together at the same time.
This is a great hobby for older people.
Right.
I don't think I've ever seen an ARP advertisement or an ARP article about ham radio. And I'm just wondering, it seems to me that maybe there's more that we could be doing. Maybe we just are too insular as a group that we're just not out there.
Well, maybe the ARRL could start advertising the hobby a little bit more or something. I don't know. I mean, just getting people excited about connecting with other people around the world. And I think the perception that people on the outside looking into our hobby is that, first of all, they're sometimes surprised that that's even a thing anymore, as you say in your intro every time. And you know, because I've had people walk down the street up at the cabin and they think that's a big TV antenna. I'm like, well, no, it's actually, I talked to China on it. And they're like, really? Tell me more, you know? And I think we all could do a better job of promoting the hobby and promoting that you don't have to have a station like mine to get started. It doesn't have to be a huge investment. And but I think maybe starting at the youth level and some of the things that we could do with, you know, with clubs could be very helpful. I think it's in all of our best interest, and certainly the manufacturers for sure that cater to our hobby. It's in everybody's best interest to promote the hobby and to invite people in and to be a positive influence on people that are looking at joining our hobby. I think that sometimes it's like a clicky club. And, you know, where people maybe shun new operators. And the analogy I use for when I'm talking to people that are new hams is, you know, every radio has a pan adapter on it now, right? So you can turn your radio on and instantly see, oh, there's nothing going on here. And to me, it reminds me of when we were in high school and you're standing around the dance floor and the lights are down, the music's going, and nobody's on the dance floor. Right. And that's kind of like what a pan adapter looks like before somebody calls CQ. But as soon as somebody gets out onto the dance floor, all of a sudden everybody's dancing. And so while pan adapters have been a boon and they're a lot of fun, but they've also been kind of, nobody just finds a frequency and just calls CQ to see if the band's open because they look at the pan adapter and there's nothing there. And so I think just promoting, just getting on the air and taking a chance and not worrying about whether you're doing it right, exactly right. And just, you know, just create that environment where people feel safe to get on the radio and start talking.
What excites you the most about what's happening in ham radio now?
What excites me the most is the technology. For me, I mean, selfishly, you know, I feel like I'm taking advantage of almost the cutting edge of the technology that's available to us today, which is important because, you know, unfortunately, you know, a lot of us are getting older in the hobby. The average age in the hobby is probably going up, not down right now. And I think that's unfortunate. But the reality is more and more of us are going to be in situations where we can't climb a tower anymore. We might be in a living arrangement that isn't conducive to having a radio or an antenna for that matter, which is, of course, the most important part of your station. And so I'm just excited that, you know, technology is being embraced in the hobby and so that we can operate this way. And, you know, I look at there's lots of ways to get on the air without even having a station these days. And a lot of people think that that's cheating or whatever. But, you know, ultimately, ham radio is a social network, right? It's a way to connect with other people using technology. It's probably one of the first social networks. It's a hobby. It's a sport. But it's also a social network. And so I'm really excited about the technology that's available to us. And I alluded to it a moment ago about the ICOM 7300. And there's radios that have come along behind that radio that are just as capable and just as inexpensive. But to me, the ICOM 7300 was revolutionary because for $1,000, you have basically state-of-the-art in front of you. And almost anybody can afford, if not a new one, a used one, because there's plenty of used ones out there now. And that excites me because it's a low barrier to entry now that anybody can get in the hobby with that radio and a long wire, you can talk around the world right now.
It's a radio that, for its price, is an order of magnitude better than anything we had when we started. I started 50 years ago, so I've got a 7300 here, and I like it a lot. I like the pan adapter. I'm not a great operator. I'm a great listener. I'm guilty of thinking that the band's empty if I don't see a bunch of activity on the pan adapter. So now I think maybe I'm going to change my tune.
Get on the dance floor.
Get on the dance floor. I love the analogy. You bring up an interesting point, and I apologize for asking the question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I think that people will maybe think the same way. You've made a tremendous investment in creating this remote station out there at the lake, but you are getting older. There could be a time, hopefully it should be a long time, but there could be a time when you are in an old age home or you are in a place where having that connection is your connection. And you're talking about the cabin. Have you thought about actually creating it as some kind of legal entity that survives you? Because I could see if you're not a ham or you're not an expert or it's 30 years later, trying to unravel this whole thing. So rather than unravel it, is it possible to create some kind of corporate asset out of it that actually could have some life that survives you?
You know, it's a great idea because a station like this that can be logged in from anywhere in the country where you have good internet with low delay. I mean, you could make it a club station. I could maybe set it up so that maybe a club inherits the station someday. And you know, there's a lot of clubs, a lot of active clubs in Minnesota. There's a lot of operators in Minnesota. It's a really, socially, it's a great place to be a ham because there's a lot of people that would love perhaps to take over the station and maintain it someday if I'm gone someday. Frankly, having this hobby for me is a way of staying away from being in a situation where you're declining. I think it's a great way to stay mentally fit and active. You know, studies have shown being socially connected is one of the leading causes of lung, or, you know, adds to your longevity, right? And so to me, I think being a ham is an antidote to having those issues. And at least I hope so, because I really enjoy it. But, you know, the beauty of it is I can operate this thing. And I have, I hurt myself biking a year and a half ago. And I was laid up in bed for a couple of days. And I had my laptop in bed. I was making contacts all over the world. So I know that I can do this almost in any situation. But you know, there was one of your recent podcasts where you, I don't remember the call sign in the, but I think it's a station in Florida where two gentlemen came together and created an LLC. And I think it's a great idea. It's a way to have this asset and have, and expand the access to it, basically.
What advice would you give to newer returning hams to the hobby?
I think the first thing that I did and that I'd recommend is reach out. I Googled different radio clubs right away and I had lunch with a good friend of mine, Chuck, Kilo Alpha 8, Hotel Delta Echo. He was a member of one of the radio clubs and I just, hey, can we have lunch? I'm a new ham. And I was wondering if you'd have lunch with me and kind of show me the ropes around the Twin Cities here socially in the hobby. And he did. And now we're good friends and he's actually a client of mine as well. And but join a club. You know, that's how I met Rich, N0HJZ, and Paul, who's a silent key now, W0AD, Denny, K0TT, Dale, I already mentioned, KD0B. You know, I met all these guys by reaching out, joining clubs, and getting, as Dale always says, radioactive. Join clubs, get connected with some people that can help you, can mentor you, can point you in the right direction, can save you a lot of time. And so join a club, buy a new radio, I think, these days, because you can, and just start with a simple wire antenna and just get on the air. And what happens, I think, is if you do that, you're connected and you're active and you've discovered the fundamental joy of the hobby, which is you call your call sign out there and someone comes back to you and says, hey, how are you? I'm in the hobby too. And it's you know, everybody's for the most part accepting in our hobby. And so the sooner you get on the air and the sooner you start making some contacts, the sooner you experience the magic and the joy of our hobby. And it's just mesmerizing to me. that there's just so many people, you know, with all the strife and the battles and all the stuff that's going on in the world. And, you know, I talk to Ukrainian stations and I talk to Russian stations. It's so amazing to me that there's hundreds of thousands of us all around the world every day, invisibly through the airwaves, right? Talking to each other and spreading goodwill and being connected. And most people don't even know this is going on. And it's just magic.
John, it's really a pleasure. I'm so happy that you said that you would come on the QSO Today podcast. I've learned so much about how to do a remote station and things I hadn't really thought about, because I think that a remote station is in the cards for a lot of us, especially in places where antenna space is limited or the noise floor is so high that it's impossible to hear anything without leaving town. So with that, I want to thank you for coming on QSO Today and wish you 73.
Well, thank you. It's truly been an honor, and this has been a lot of fun.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with John. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put an NG0Z in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some of the episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, please contact me. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing on the subscribe buttons on the show notes page. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. Use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on what you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform, including Spotify and the iTunes Store. Until next time, this is Eric 4Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.